core device. So that's actually a sense of arriving in our body, arriving in the room, in the place that we're actually sitting in, inhabiting, but also in this virtual space on this retreat where we're going to be connecting with the retreat community. And arriving in our experience as well. On online retreat, we can just sort of like be dashing about doing something and then just sit down, switch on our device, get on the internet, and then we're there. So we don't have the transition time of even just walking from one room to another, one building to another that you would get usually on a residential retreat. But just consciously realizing we're entering into a different space. In a way, this Zoom space is our shrine room. So there's something sacred about it and something about having that intention of connecting with something that's important to us, being receptive to the Dharma practices, teachings, and connecting with whatever it is that has brought us here. That keeps us practicing meditation, keeps us exploring the teachings of the Dharma, that sort of shraddha, something within us resonating with something we can recognize as being true or meaningful or of a different level of reality to our everyday lives. While at the same time being exactly the same. So if I'm honest, I'm also needing to arrive here. I've been kind of a bit trying to get my thoughts together. I just had a little bit longer. And then that's part of reality, isn't it? We have to be with what is the situation, whatever it is, even if it's not what we would prefer. And that is all very relevant to the fourth reminder. The topic of which is dukkha and the defects of samsara. I mean, I don't actually like that word defects particularly. I came across someone else calling it shortcomings, which I did prefer, but it's something about the unsatisfactoriness of samsara and of living in this conditioned world. Yeah. So what I'm going to be doing is I'm going to be exploring the fourth reminder, but I'm also going to be looking at it in the context of the other reminders and also maybe the reminders as a whole, since this is the last of the teaching input sessions on the retreat, so have a little bit of an overview and how they interrelate as well. And it's where to start, really? but it's interesting that the Buddha, after, Pranyaniti yesterday was talking about the Buddha and the Four Watches of the Night and all the insights he was having, which interestingly do link in quite a lot with the other reminders. You know, he had that whole awareness of impermanence, of conditionality, of seeing all of his past lives and rebirths, and also seeing other people and everything coming into being and passing away and the conditions that led to that. And so some of that was karma in actions leading to certain consequences and other things on a much wider level. But I suppose what's interesting is that when he had that insight, when he had his awakening, in a way, what he focuses on first is the Four Noble Truths about the fact of dukkha, the fact of suffering, unsatisfactoriness, that there is dukkha. And then he tries to sort of diagnose, well, what are the causes of that suffering? Which he comes to as craving, yeah? And then he also thinks, well, there actually is a path, there is a way that we can, that leads from suffering. So I just want to sort of make the, clarify that when we talk about suffering and unsatisfactory, so we're kind of using the word dukkha, and it's not the same as that there's never going to be things that are painful or difficult. You know, dukkha means that things are unsatisfactory. There is pain, there is suffering, there are things that are unpleasant, a lot of which are outside of our control. But the suffering that we can, in a way, free ourselves from is how we respond to that, you know, our reaction to the suffering. We cause ourselves a lot of extra suffering. And one of the ways we do that is by not actually seeing things as they are, not aligning ourselves with reality. And why do we do that? Well, I think most of us, we just want to be happy, don't we? We want security. Most of us don't really want to think about our souls or people we care about dying. So although we have talked about how impermanence can have a more positive aspect to us as well, and it allows change to happen, allows choices, and the whole idea of conditionality is reliant on the fact that there is impermanence, that things do change. But it's difficult, isn't it? The fact that things change. We want things, especially if things are the way that we feel comfortable or we feel happy or secure, we want them to stay like that indefinitely, don't we? Want to hang on to it, you know? And I think underlying that, you know, it is very scary, isn't it? When you don't know what's going to happen, when there's so much change, uncertainty. I think we've all been experiencing that very strongly over the last year, when so much has been changing, there has been so much uncertainty. You can't really rely or plan on anything, even sometimes up to a week in advance, because things change, or the laws change, or we're in lockdown, we're not in lockdown, or there's this happening, or there's a new strain, or COVID-19, and then all the conditions change. So, you know, people don't really know how things are going to be in a year's time or in a few months' time, and that's hard to deal with. But that's in a way just a more in-our-face version of what is always there, which is dukkha and impermanence as parts of reality, parts of our conditioned existence, part of samsara. So we cause ourselves quite a lot of suffering by not wanting to accept that, or trying to push it away, ignore it, avoid it. One of the things that we do with that is we try and find ways to reassure ourselves, to give ourselves a sense of safety or security. So we have this phrase, going for refuge to the three jewels of the Buddha, the Dharma, the Sangha, and it can sound a bit jargony, it can become a bit jargony or shorthand, when you're not really thinking about what you're saying. It's just, oh yeah, going for refuge to the three jewels. It was one of the things that is central, you know, to our practice as Buddhists, and I think to all Buddhists, is that actually that practice of going for refuge to the three jewels. And it dates right back to the very earliest accounts we have of the Buddha when he was going around meeting all kinds of people and often sharing his teaching. And quite often, just on the spot, they would have this very strong experience. You know, we talk about the four reminders as being mind turnings, being transformational. And you get that in the descriptions, you know, and their responses when he gives them a teaching. It's like they get it, they have a different kind of perspective, heart opening, mind opening. And then what they say is, well, A, how wonderful it is to have seen all this, and, you know, how freeing it is, and they're seeing things they never saw. It's like the world being put right for them in a way. But then the next thing they do is they say, to the Buddha for refuge I go, to the Dharma for refuge I go, to the Sangha for refuge I go. And quite often they will then join the community or of the Buddha's disciples, or go off wandering, or at least bring the teachings into their lives. So we've had that phrase going back thousands of years, you know, back to the Buddha's time, and we still use it. And I must say, sometimes I've thought, well, why do we use this? Going for refuge, going for refuge. But there is that sense of, in a way, we are always looking for a refuge, a safe place, a harbour, a sense of security in our lives. And that links very much into a teaching of true and false refuges, in the fact that we often try and find that safety, try and find that security in things that will not actually provide that in the long term, because we are looking for it in things that are impermanent, things that are conditioned. So we're trying to protect ourselves, we're trying to fix things, and then we'll go for things like, well, if I had the perfect job, if I, you know, if I had a good career, if I had the right relationship, if I had, you know, if I had a nice house, if I had enough money, if I had this, if I had that. We can find so many different ways of trying to create that sense of safety, that sense of security, that sense of I'm trying to think of the word. Well, yeah, that sense that we're in control, maybe. And I think it very much is linked to our ego and our sense of identity. So that very root delusion of us being a fixed self, separate from others. There's me and you. Things are mine or not mine. And that is, in a way, the root of all the different kinds of dualities, polarities that we can approach life with and see things as. So with dukkha or unsatisfactoriness or suffering, we're told there's sort of three main ways we experience dukkha. One is when we don't get what we want, you know, so that very closely obviously links in with craving, you know. And it's not just that we're craving certain things, you know, like maybe I'm craving a chocolate bar, or maybe I'm craving a holiday, or maybe I'm craving, you know, a new relationship or something. So it can be something specific we're craving, but it can also be craving for things to be the way we want them to be. So that very much links into the second way that we can experience dukkha, which is getting what we don't want. You know, we're not in control of the world, we're not in control of our environment, we're not in control of all of our lives. You know, we've talked very clearly, like in the third reminder, about karma. So we do have agency over our actions of body, speech, and mind, of our responses, our reactions to what we experience. And by by acting consciously in that, we can make choices. Yeah, we can make positive choices, and that's part of the basis of our sort of spiritual path, is doing that. But what we can't do is control things however much we want to. And our egos do like to try and feel in control and create that illusion of being in control and convince ourselves that we are, you know, and that things will stay the same, that this is how things are. And will often sort of kick back in quite undermining or unhelpful ways, trying to protect that worldview. And it's not that the things that there's anything wrong with, you know, wanting to have a good job, have a career, have a partner, a relationship, and all the other things that we might want in our lives to give our lives sort of meaning. But it's more about how we relate to them, really. How we use them as almost like a panacea, as a way of trying to stop ourselves from realizing that actually things are impermanent, actually, yeah, maybe we will die one day. Actually, there is a lot of dukkha out there, you know. So it's more than being emotionally resilient, but it's sort of like if we have a perspective on life, a dharmic perspective on life, where we actually realized that impermanence and dukkha are part of, you know, part of life, yeah, part of the world, part of conditioned reality, then we don't spend so much time in trying to avoid it or battling against it or being in conflict with it, yeah, because we can't actually avoid things that we aren't in control of. You know, we can't avoid the fact that there is a pandemic out there. You know, we can't avoid a lot of conditions in the world that are outside our control. As Pranayanita was saying, there's a lot of conditionality and causality that is outside of our control. So, yeah, it's a bit like just recognizing that, accepting it, being open to it, you know. So when we reflect on the shortcomings of samsara, it helps us to kind of align ourselves more with reality. It helps us to, I suppose, make those choices. Well, this is the reality. You know, well, what, how, what's the best way? What is most meaningful? How do I want to spend my time? So again, with the other reminders where we were thinking about impermanence and the preciousness of human life, the two being very closely linked, that because things aren't permanent, because they don't last, because we have a very limited amount of time there, then this life is precious. You know, how are we going to live our lives? What are the things we're going to do? You know, what impact will we have on the world and on other people, as well as on ourselves? And I think one of the things that we've been talking about quite a lot is Buddha nature and that intrinsic sense of, well, but deep down we are essentially pure. You know, we have this Buddha nature, we have all these seeds that can develop and grow. We can become like a Buddha or a Bodhisattva. The idea of like our basic goodness, and I think a lot of us are focused on our shortcomings and the things that we don't feel good about ourselves, which is part of conditionality, part of dukkha. And then we undermine ourselves. We maybe feel that there's no point in trying. That we can't have a positive effect on the world, or we can't change. And it's quite an important shift to have, to think, well, actually, there's nothing wrong with me. Actually, I'm good enough. And actually, if I can get to it, if I can uncover it, It's not just that I'm good enough, but I have this Buddha nature. I'm just going to give a quote from Pema Chodron. When you come from the view that you're fundamentally good rather than fundamentally flawed, as you see yourself speak or act out, as you see yourself repress, you will have a growing understanding that you're not a bad person who needs to shape up, but a good person with temporary malleable habits that are causing you a lot of suffering. And then, in that spirit, you can become very familiar with these temporary but strongly embedded habits. We all carry around trunkloads of old habits, but very fortunately for us, they're removable. She also goes on to say, we already have everything we need. There's no need for self-improvement. All these trips that we lay on ourselves, and a heavy-duty fear that we're bad, hoping we're good, the identities we so dearly cling to, and the rage, the jealousy, all kinds of addictions, they never actually touch our basic wealth. They are like clouds that temporarily block the sun, but all the time our warmth and brilliance are right there. This is who we really are. We are one blink of an eye away from being fully awake. So I don't know whether I actually experience myself as being just like one blink of an eye away from being fully awake, but I do have glimpses, I do have times when I do experience myself in a different kind of way and what I can be, and maybe a glimpse of that or aspects of that Buddha nature. And I'm sure all of you have at times as well. And this awakening process is interesting because awakening the heart, awakening the mind, is very much trying to get to that place. So we have all these metaphors for spiritual practice. We've got the lotus, growing its roots in the mud, tight bud, half bud, flowing with Tara, she holds the lotus, three lotus flowers at different stages of development, the tight bud, fully open flowering blossom, and the half open blossom. We have the diamond, which weighs about the Buddha nature that can be discovered within or and then allowed to shine forth. And this, and the idea of a path that we progress on. And it's interesting to, because not each one of them speaks to a different part of ourselves and a different part of our practice, I think. And can we hold them all? Like we may experience ourselves progressing on a path sometimes, but there isn't an actual path there. We may experience ourselves growing, developing, unfolding, blossoming, and we may uncover, discover, there's that sense of obscurations, mind coverings, heart coverings that get in the way of us being all of who we could be. So I think the reason why this idea of Buddha nature kind of connects quite well with the four reminders is as we're being reminded of all these things like impermanence, like the unsatisfactoriness of samsara and like dukkha, we also have that positive understanding view that actually, if we're more receptive, if we open, if we allow ourselves to be that, that can happen. It's not this massive journey of lifetime upon lifetime upon lifetime. We can be doing the work now in all kinds of little incremental ways to uncover that Buddha nature, and that will then help us even if we have little glimpses, it will help us on that path and help us on that journey. And I like that idea of stopping identifying with our weaknesses and shifting allegiance to our basic goodness, understanding our limitations are not absolute, but relative, and that you can change, that Buddha nature is potentially available to us at any time. So experience dukkha all the time, externally in the world, in our lives, and also internally in our experiences of our body, our experiences emotionally, psychologically, feeling thoughts. And that's one reason why it's really helpful to have a meditation practice, to have an ethical practice, to be reflecting on the Dharma. So in a way, we're talking about the threefold path, that you need to do all three of them. But as Praninita was saying yesterday, when she was quoting the opening verses of the Dhammapada, experiences are led by, preceded by mind and led by mind, and in a way, the root of all our actions, body, speech, and mind, are coming from our mind, our mental state. Yeah. So, if we become more aware, if we bring mindfulness, awareness, if we're cultivating more insight, all of that will have a beneficial effect on the choices we make, how we act in the world, our ethical choices, skillfulness, unskillfulness, the degree that we are becoming more skillful, kinder, more generous, have more clarity, have all the things that we're trying to cultivate, equanimity, compassion, gladness, all those things, and many more. Those are all very much coming initially from our mind, and I don't just mean our thoughts, but I mean our mind and our heart's mind, not that link, citta, connecting the two. But it's not just, we can't just sit there on our meditation cushions and be working with our minds and then that have no impact when we go out in the world and our actions in the world. And of course, it's the same mind that we're bringing. Whether we're on or off the cushion, it's all the same habits and patterns and views and delusions that we have on and off the cushion. But I think when we're meditating, we have a particular space where we can look at it and work with it, be with it, without having to try and deal with other things. But then hopefully that informs how we are in the world, and how we are in the world will then have an effect when we're meditating. And we need to be constantly trying to gain more, I suppose, more awareness, more insight into reality and the way things really are, is the phrase we often use in Buddhism. And the way things are, including impermanence, including dukkha, including the fact that our actions do have consequences. And including the fact that we are here for a very limited amount of time, that we are going to die. So it's not necessarily a gloomy thing to be aware that you're going to die. It can actually just give you a lot of motivation and think, yeah, I really want to make the most of the time I'm here, really value it. It's a really precious opportunity being here, being a human being in the world right now, regardless of what my personal circumstances are, what's happening in the world. Just the fact of being alive offers a lot of opportunities, and each of us have that potential, to, well, to do good for others. Yeah. To, if our actions are skillful, they'll have beneficial effects on ourselves and others in the world. And if we're aware of that and we make that choice, then we don't know all the effects, but we're sowing those seeds and we're sending stuff out into the world. That we do know will have beneficial effects at some time. We don't know when or how necessarily, the seeds within us or the fruits of our actions well, but we can be confident that actually, if you're coming from a place of kindness and generosity and compassion, coming from a place of care and wisdom, that it will have a positive effect, even if at the time it may not be obvious or your actions may not be well received. You can still have that faith, actually. So in terms of dukkha, it just keeps on coming back to, in a way, us wanting things to be a certain way and they're not, you know, and us wanting to change things, fix samsara, and looking for that, trying to do that in ways that aren't necessarily going to be effective. So if we reflect on this fourth reminder, if we are aware of dukkha, if we're aware of the shortcomings, the defects of samsara, that can help us to realize that we're doing that, to maybe make that shift, to turn our minds towards what may be more meaningful, may actually give us a deeper, lasting sense of freedom, liberation, security, whatever else it is. And I think a lot of us during this this last year maybe have had that experience, and even people who aren't particularly following any kind of spiritual path, they are questioning what's important in their lives. They are realizing it actually, the things that they've done all their lives may not actually be ultimately satisfying or a sense of security. You know, maybe they've been in a job for many, many years, going to the office every day, you know, well up on the career ladder, they've got all these plans and everything, and then this thing happens and none of it is secure or safe. It's all impermanent, isn't it? So it's basically being aware that certain things could be useful, that could be enjoyable, we might still want them in our lives, but they're not ultimately going to give us that safety, that refuge. And we can't actually protect ourselves from samsara or fix samsara. And seeing ourselves in a little bit of a drama, us against the world, us against all the things that are difficult, you know, I don't know about you, but I do have a tendency sometimes to take dukkha, to take impermanence, to take samsara a bit personally, rather than that's just how it is, you know. And when I am able to have that perspective, then there's a whole lot of letting go, and there's a whole lot of actually just being with what is and having that opportunity of being there more fully. And often it's quite a creative, quite a joyful place. Even though there's part of me that resists like anything, when I do let myself do that, it can be really liberating. So in a way, we can't control things, but we can create positive conditions, and that's slightly different for me. You know, you're creating conditions for those things that can emerge. Creating that momentum that Pranidhi was talking about, I love that image of the snowball actually. You set it rolling and it has that, gets bigger and bigger, it has this momentum. In terms of like metaphor for our practice, and I think by reflecting on, well, all of the four reminders, that's what we end up doing, really. It's interesting, there's another translation of the four reminders as, I think it's thoughts that turn your mind to the Dharma. And, you know, we've heard how they're seen as an ordinary preliminary practice. I like the fact that they're an ordinary practice. Yeah, an ordinary preliminary practice that are sort of like the foundation for everything and for practice. But they are also, in a way, seen as gateways to insight and awakening. And almost all the Insight practices do involve some kinds of reflection on things like dukkha and impermanence, which is what we've got in the Four Reminders as well. Anyway, I think I've said a lot, and I think it would be good to just maybe leave it there. So we're going to have a mantra just to have that transition from being very much perhaps in the head from all the talking I've been doing. And then we'll have a short sit, and then we'll come back and do a bit more practice and maybe have a bit more reflection. So, if you just want to get yourselves comfortable in a meditation posture, I will chant Green Tara Mantra. Green Tara being someone that we can always call on for help. Traditionally, when there are threatening things happening, when we're from the eight great terrors she protects us or comes and rescues us from. So again, that sense of looking for help, looking for safety, looking for refuge, but maybe in an archetypal transcendental Buddha figure and all these qualities of enlightenment. And in doing so, connecting with our own inner Tara, our own Buddha nature. Om Tare Tu Tare Ture Swaha. 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 Om Tare Tu Tare Tu Tare Swaha. Om Tare. tire to a swan. Om tire to a swan. Om tire to a swan. Om tire tutare to a swan. Om tare 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 tutare to a swan. Just sitting, What if there is no need to change? No need to try and transform yourself into someone more compassionate, more present, more loving, more wise? How would this affect all the places in your life where you are endlessly trying to be better? What if the task is simply to unfold, to become who you already are in your essential nature? Gentle, compassionate, and capable of living fully and passionately present. What if the question is not, why am I so infrequently the person I really want to be? But, why do I so infrequently want to be the person I really am? What if becoming who and what we truly are happens not through striving and trying, but by recognizing and receiving the people and places and practices that are for us the warmth of encouragement we need to unfold? How would this shape the choices you make about how to spend today? What if you knew that the impulse to move in a way that creates beauty in the world will arise from deep within and guide you every time you pay attention and wait? How would this shape your stillness, your movement, your willingness to follow this impulse, to just let go and dance? So we're going to have a tea break for about 10 minutes. Chance to stretch, move about, do whatever you need to do. And then we'll come back for a sort of more practice-based, reflection-based exploration. And you may want to be lying down because there'll be quite a lot of body focused. Sort of body scan with four reminders thrown in, perhaps. Anyway, whatever's comfortable for you. So if we can get back here, let's say for 11:45.